Accession number 10165, reel number 41.
McLean, reel 41. You were telling me what the events that happened at the Indian Brigade headquarters in that area.
Yes, you've got to consider that in my company we had young raw recruits, young lads who hadn't been in battle. And when we give them this rum, it booked them up no end, because it was pretty strong stuff. Now, I'd like to stop there for a moment. There's been no true account yet of the Battle of Indin, of what happened there with regard to the brigadier and the brigade major, and all transpired in that thing. Now, we had a second divisional commander called Inge, who commanded the second div way back in 1986. And he had me before him with the other brigadiers, and I told him the Battle of Indin, because they have a man who's with them at the time called Lewis Allen, who wrote The Longest War, Burma. Marvellous book to read. But he had got his wires crossed somehow, and he put a different kettle of fish, a different story, a different slant of the story, in his book. It was the Japanese version. Well, anyway, what I tell you now is absolute truth. And I, as I say, I'm a God-fearing man, go to my church on Sunday. What I tell you is a history of the Battle of Indin. I've mentioned about the atmosphere of the whole place. Now, you've got to imagine men after a battle. The gunners were happy that they broke up the Japanese. Everyone was frightened. Well, they were frightened because it seems so many of the men killed. They'd been caught with their trousers down. Now, it's sad to say, when Captain Stock came back from his old group, he said, "Sarmage, come here." Actual wordings. He said, "Have a look up that hill there. What do you see?" And you could see people digging in. They looked like Indians digging in. But he says, "Have another look through the binoculars." He gives us his binoculars. And there was Japanese digging in, right up on top of the hill, overlooking all our area. In other words, once they got dug in, they could shoot everybody up. Gunners, the lot. There'd be no getting out of anyone. And tied in front of these positions, in the middle of these positions, where they were digging right round them, was a man in a whitish outfit and a one in front of him in a whitish outfit. And the company commander, Roger Stock, said to me, he says, "Sarmager, that's the brigadier and that's the brigade major." They called the brigadier Brigadier Cavendish, and they called the brigade major Basil Fanshawe. I only got these from Roger Stock. He says they've been captured in their pyjamas and the Japs have tied them to that tree. Now they're daring everyone to shoot at them. Even if we shoot with Bren guns, the way we would shoot would hit them. They were right in the middle, tied openly in pyjamas on this tree. He says that there's a serious discussion going on in the group of brigade headquarters now where the remnants are. He says they've got to decide whether to shoot up with the Royal Artillery and knock out these Japanese and at the same time kill the brigadier and his brigade major. He says, because it's obvious to all of us, if them people get dug in there properly, there's no one to get out of here alive. He says, but in the meantime, we have to move out and go on the attack up that hill feature over there. We came in one end of this area of Indin. We crossed the front and saw the devastation and the dead people lying around. Somebody had been trying to tidy up the British dead bodies, but the Japs are just lying strewn all over, and Indians. We had to go at the far end, which was the nearer end to India, and we had to cross a wide river to attack up a hill where the Japs had also gone in. In other words, the Japs are right around us. And it was the infantry's job to clear them out. Now, they're going to try to do this thing in bounds, with the use of the Royal Artillery, who were great in this instance. They had a number of vehicles left, and they intended to drive them along the beach and the carriers, track vehicles. They were going to load the carriers and track vehicles up as much as they could and send them along to give cover and fire on these hills. And then the lorries had to pass by, and then they were going to get one group of the guns out. And once the guns got a certain way along the beach, so they unhitch, drop their trail, and start firing back into the perimeter, whereas the ones that left behind were now firing onto the hills that we had to attack. And that was the mode of doing it. So just to get the picture right, we had all these carriers, we had the soft vehicles, the ordinary three-ton trucks and that sort of thing, water carts. And they had the Royal Artillery with their vehicles, and there's some ambulances there as well. And they all had to be got out of this place. By the way, I found myself a folding camp bed, which, you know, to get off the ground, it was a great thing. It was an abandoned piece of equipment. In my outhouse, the coal house there now, I've got a writing case, which was some officer's writing case. It'd been abandoned and strung out. And I have that. It's all damaged. And I've kept that as a souvenir. I've still got it. This little writing case and this camp bed. Now, I put the camp bed on the water truck. I said, well, if anything's going out, the rum will go out, that'll go out. And I said, I might get it back. So it happens I did get it back. We'll leave that story now. So the idea was to get all of the vehicles out along the beach. As soon as the tide dropped, so the tide had to drop because, as I said, the river was tidal waters. And the trucks couldn't plough through deep water. They'd get through along the beach when the tide was well out. As soon as the tide went out, away went rushing the vehicles, covered by the carriers, giving them support and giving them cover and fire. And they, you know, and the Royal Artillery opened up on these hills where the Japs were. Now, I've jumped there. Excuse me, jumping. I must tell you about the brigadier and the brigade major. As we moved off, the order was given to shoot up this position where the Japs were. Now, we stopped because we're in the line of the trajectory, not the trajectory, but the bang of the guns, and just on our left. So we got down on the ground where the shoot took place. And we saw the Japanese positions being hit. And I personally say, and I say over and over again on any sort of Bible, that we saw the brigadier and the major hit and slump in the trees. Were gone, you could see. Company commander came to me, he says, Sarmager, they had to take that chance. And he gave me his binoculars, and I could see them slumped. I couldn't see any wounds on them, but they were both supported to the trees now by rope. To deviate slightly, the Japanese now say, when it was brought up later on by someone unknown, I don't know who it was, that the brigadier was not tied to trees, that he was found on a track leading away from Endin, with a lump of British shrapnel in him, and also his escort of a Japanese soldier was also dead beside him. That's their story, but that is a false story, and I defy anyone to say any other. Now, all of the men who I know were at Endin, they say, I knew it had happened, but we didn't see it. I think they're frightened to say it. I'm not. One of my friends, Jack Felton, he's on that picture up there, he was in brigade headquarters when this happened. And when I speak to him about it, and then he just shuts up, maybe he kept his head down, I don't know. People get frightened, they kept their head down. But anyway, our brigadier and the brigade major got killed by our own artillery, which, sad to say, the shooting by the Royal Artillery was forced upon us, or as hundreds of men would never have got out of that position, because there's all the Durhams and all the corps troops and different people like that, and a lot of Indians as well. Well, anyway, we went across this river, and as we crossed this river to go attacking up on these hills, the artillery was hitting the hill. A Japanese spotter plane circled just low above us, and no one shot at him. We found, I think, now by through Germany, it was a waste of time trying to shoot an aircraft down. You just couldn't hit them, no matter what sort of shoot you use, whether it was a combine shoot or what it was, but you just couldn't hit aircraft. And he was floating up, just taking a good look at us as we crossed this river. Anyway, we attacked this hill, but when the Japs saw us coming up the hill, they weren't properly prepared. They scarpered. There's nothing on the hill. So we were sad to relieve because we had these young lads who'd never been in battle before. They were keen enough, they were going forward with their bayonets on, and I'm quite sure they would have done a good account, but you always like to get your men blooded nice and easy. We got on top of this hill, and then once we were on, the rest of the units all started coming out of Endin. And we saw the hurry and the bustle of the artillery, because now they were getting worried about these Japs that were infiltrating on the left, as I saw before. In other words, nobody took notice of these Japs. We don't know how many got through. Might have been a battalion that could come along that beach and swipe the rest. Anyway, everyone was now in a great hurry to get out of Endin. They got out with a swirl and a lot of gust, lots of artillery firing, and I thought the artillery done wonders. They slammed everything that they had along the beaches on the hills while all this movement was going on, and what they never seemed to stop. As I mentioned, they'd done a leapfrog action, and they'd done a great job. So we all got out of Indin, leaving the remnants smoking and stinking and all the dead. A little further back, there was another bit of a dry bit, another river. We crossed the river by a small bridge, and my company was told to take a position near there. And the company deployed across the front from the sea right as far as we could into a perimeter. Now, on this occasion, we didn't make all-round defence, because behind us was battalion headquarters and brigade headquarters and all the different core troops, and lots of people behind us. So we just done a frontal, and other companies joined up to make a circle right round this area. The instructions we received were the Royal Berkshires have been lost. They'll most likely come up to you in a short while. And if you see a column of troops coming, don't shoot on them. They are the Royal Berks. And the command officer's name is Colonel Drew. And that is the password. Colonel, halt, who goes there? Colonel. And the answer will be Drew. You know, they've been in touch with sets. So we keep looking for these people, and we're sorry for them, because anyone caught out there could catch the full blast of the Japanese. Well, I saw a column coming in the distance, and they were black. And they weren't the British. And I was standing watching them. I was right up in the forward positions. And I said, hold your fire. Because then again, you couldn't be sure of Indians, because some of them were fighting for the Japanese army. And all wearing the national Indian uniform, the turbans and everything. But then I recognised them as they come along. They were machine gunners. They were carrying the tripod on the shoulders in the battle, and they had all the ammunition cases and everything. There was quite a lot of them, and it came in single file, snaking towards us. I don't know whether the Japs was following them up, but just about that time, the Japs start shelling this position, or grenading. I don't know what they were, but there were shells or missiles falling in and around us. And these poor Jats, and I was waving to them, this way. And they came towards us, and they were panicking, because where we were, these things were dropping. I don't know whether spring grenades used by the Japanese who'd followed up and there were mortars. I don't know, but some of them were quite heavy. And I stood there shouting at the Japanese, Baito, don't hurry, because when you're in a line like that, the men were getting panicky, the Indians. They were walking into a fire. They start running, and the people at the back never have a chance of catching up. And once you get a column like that, where the front has got away, you never catch up again, because it's a slow, ponderous movement. It's a long column of troops in single file. So the answer was to keep them, stop running, keep quiet, pass through us. And that's all I was standing there shouting, Baito, nix hasty. That means don't go fast. Anyway, they passed through us, scared and frightened. And this grenade of bombs went on for quite some time. And the company commander was standing looking at me. He says, get down, Sergeant. He wasn't standing. Get down, Sergeant. But I knew if I stood there, these Indians would realise that everything was right. And they came out, and they were still panicking. They were still broke their march discipline before, because they were now in British hands and were so delighted. The front started hurrying up there, maybe let the last men get in quicker. Maybe they knew the Japs were following them. I don't know. But they all got through us. But the outcome was, when they got through, we found the barrel of a Vickers machine gun, which is a very precious weapon, and a tripod. Somebody got a court-martial for dumping them, unless the man had been wounded. That was fair enough. Or the people had been wounded. But I'd never seen anybody hit whilst I was standing there. We collected these things because in my old men of that was left the battalion, we had some Vickers machine gunners. So we took these guns to bits and cleaned them. They were rusted. It just surprised me. I thought the Indian units were so particular. The guns were rusted through lack of maintenance, which is common with the Indians or black people, I'd say. They just neglect mechanisms. But we couldn't get any belts, so So I sent a message back to our battalion HQ, can you get us any Vickers machine gun belts? Just deviating slightly. Next morning, the message was sent up by the ordinary runners, or sometime during the day, I don't know when. Don't bother with that machine gun. The unit will send people to collect it immediately. So we lost the Vickers machine gun. We had it set up, all it was the belts. Beautiful field of fire ready for them.
What sort of defensive positions do you set up there? I mean, you hadn't had much time.
Well, all we could do was scrape holes in the ground with our helmets and whatever we had. We had entrenching tools and dig the little spade, you know, that they carried on the back, and dig a shallow sort of scrape positions. Now, funny enough, the one on the right near the beach was a properly made defensive position, and it was abandoned, so we had a section of men in there. We had very primitive method of defence. We didn't have picks and shovels and the engineer's equipment to make a good job defence. It was only makeshift cover. The section on our right, everybody been warned about the Royal Berkshires coming in. They were near the wider mouth of this river or chong that poured out from the mountains, and they were near on the beach, you could see, in the sea on the right. And a group of men came along, like a section strong, came along the beach, and they gave them the challenge, halt, who goes there? And these men ran towards the guns, ran towards the position. And the guns opened up on them, killed some of them. And sad to say, the Royal Berkshires, a section of Royal Berkshires had got separated and were making their way along the beach to find somebody. And it was surmised that on hearing British voices, they were delighted they ran towards them, you know, scared they were lost. Which, if you're not under control, can be a very scary thing. So some of these lads were killed, but we never did see the Royal Berks. Now, we're getting no food at this time. We're lucky to get water. I went back to battalion headquarters to see what was happening, because the sergeant major had to look after his men, and the officers as well, to see if we could get any food rustled up. And all around us, mules had been hit by shells and wounded. A sad sight to see. And there was Indians near them. I thought the Indians should have shot the poor beasts. Someone should have shot them, because they were just standing there helpless and looking so placid, you know, so waiting for something to happen, waiting for someone to look after them. Just like human beings when they're wounded, as a matter of fact. I got back to battalion headquarters, and they had no food, so that was that. We had to stick it. We weren't in these positions very long when we got the order to move out once again. We moved back to a further, deeper position, because in this place where we're in a wooded area, and apparently it didn't suit the commanders. They wanted a more open area. Don't know what. It was part of the stage of moving back. So we moved back and took up this front position again, on the other side of a bigger canal, a bigger river. All this area was riddled with rivers coming from the Mayo Peninsula, pouring down when the monsoons came on. And we took a position on there, my company being Ford Company once again. And the company commander shouted us once, he said, great, Samaji, he says, there's some food coming up. Take some men and go and collect it further back there. So back I went. You never saw the CQMS who was in charge of food, by the way. They were miles away, the quartermaster's branch. So back I went and found where this dump was of food. And I don't know who was this unit to us, but we're given a sack about 2 foot wide, 2 foot deep, and about 9 inches wider, or 6 inches wider, something like that. A well-secured sack, and it was one per section. So we collected our our lot, and off we went, carrying them on our backs, no mules, to the different sections and distribute them sections. We had one for company headquarters. Well, I ripped open the string with a knife or something, cut the string, and looked inside, and you could see the biscuits, but you could smell the smell as well. It was rotten. The whole ruddy lot was rotten. Now, this is... You've often heard said that the infantry are the worst looked after in the army. And I'll say it over and over again. My experience of food coming up the infantry, you are the last people I thought of is given food to, and yet it depends so much on you. The food was absolutely rotten. What had happened was, there were sacks of food in these containers, mainly consisting of the hardtack biscuits. And on the bottom, there was 12 tins of corned beef, and there was a piece of plywood, and it stacked the tins of corned beef, the packets of biscuits, maybe two or three packets a man, around the inside, and it put a bag of sugar, a bag of tea, a bag of powdered milk, and cigarettes and matches. And somebody had stuck in the middle of them all, believe it or not, a jar of pickled onions or a jar of beetroots. And with the airdrop, they start dropping the supplies down to us. They were a free fall drop. They weren't on parachutes. They were just slung out and dropped. The stuff busted, the pickles and the jam or whatever was in the middle. I don't know how long they'd lain there. But when we got them, the whole of the food was useless. We put ground sheets on the bottom, and we opened it up and just tipped it slowly out. And the weavers and everything was gnawing among. The weavers are the little beetles that get in among food, like maggots, and tipped them out. And we got the 12 tins of corned beef. That was our food for goodness knows how long since.
Was that your first airdrop? Because you said you before.
That
you
was the first. That was our first supply by the... We were told it had been brought in by air. They just must have just slung it off the aircraft. Anyway, I keep saying anyway, I should stop it. The 12 tins of corned beef, you know how they are. They're lovely when you get them out of a fridge or they're kept in a cool place. But these things had been lying out in the open in the burning sun of Burma. So when we opened them, we got a gluey liquid mixture coming out of them. And we found if we put holes in the tin and poured the liquid out, you could get some portion of the corned beef, which was hot and not very palatable for eat. That was our first food for quite some time. And it was our last food for quite some time as well. Now, this is what gets you off your back. You know fine well that the food's coming down. The people at the base must be getting theirs, but the poor men at the front, just ignore them. They are just infantry. They are the end of the line. That was the true expression.
What about water supplies?
Water supplies, we'll get them out of chungs and rivers, bits of springs and everything. There was no salt in the water then. We were enjoying it, more or less. But again, you had to be very careful. You didn't get dysentery. It was prevalent in the area.
Did you boil it then?
No, we didn't have the facilities for boiling. We didn't want to make smoke to show the enemy where we were. So you just drank it as it was. Nor did we have tablets to put in. Nor did we have any salt tablets. We were very primitive, you've got to remember. We were still in khaki, still white toes, still white vests, very much dirtied now. And that was the situation at that time, being poorly fed and poorly looked after. We started going back in different stages like that. Take a position, move further back. We moved back to one position, and there were some very high hills beside us. And the company commander said, this is where we stay, Sarmager. And there's a rather deep chung running in front of us. And we knew the Japs were following up because the Gurkhas had been out. Some Gurkha patrol had been out and reported them in the vicinities, you know. We were up on this high hill protecting. And two little incidents happened there, which I'd just like to talk about, which is different from being just in defence, standing, looking and waiting for enemy. The men of the platoons were up on the high hills, and I'd been up seeing their ammunition supply, having a chat with the sergeants. And I come down to my company HQ, was in a bit of a basin near the roadway, so the ambulance men could handle get up quickly for the stretcher, you know, wounded and things like that. It was where Roger Stock had said his company headquarters. And we had a young officer, a big tall man called Bell, who'd been with us all the time. We were in the same vicinity when a shot rang out, and said, "What's that?" You know, because everyone, what's happening? Anything in front of you? Is there an attack coming in straight away? So everybody in a queue of him. A young lad had self-inflicted wound through his foot, and he was wriggling and screaming in agony. And Lieutenant Bell says to me, "Get the stretcher bearers on me. See what we do for this man." I said, "Stop, sir. Wait. Let this man wriggle. Let him scream." I was a bit cruel here, but there was a point in it. The men were getting very downhearted, a lack of support now, and lack of being looked after. And if they found an easy way of getting out, I'm sure others would have followed. So I told Captain Bell, Lieutenant Bell, I said, let this man wriggle, sir. Let all them men up the hill, they're all looking down now to see what the shot was. The same wriggling, the same screaming, and they'll get no, it's a self-inflicted injury. What I'm trying to impress upon them is that self-inflicted injuries are not easy. They can be very hurtful. They're not just a simple shooting yourself through the foot and getting away with it. So this man wriggled on the ground for about 10 minutes. And I said, right, stretcher bearers, go and see to him. And they tended to him. And this had a profound effect on the company. You bloody callous bugger. But when I told the officers why I'd done it, they agreed with us. And because, as I said, the men were getting a bit, you know, what are we doing here? Faint-hearted. That was the first example. If one had done it, others might have followed. If they thought that they were all going to be like this man, carted out to the rear to a hospital. I don't know ever what happened. I didn't send any charges in against the man. That wasn't up to me. The company commander might report him. I don't know, but that was something that I didn't want to touch.
And it was a one-off, was it? Or did you?
It was just the only one I ever met in the whole of me service with the Durhams. The only one. A short while after this, we'd been informed a patrol had gone out with a great corporal who was in A Company when I was in the sarmage of the company. And they call him McCleary or Clutchy or something of that nature. He was a Scotch lad. Wonderful, keen soldier. And he took a patrol out to go and try to find out where the Japs were. Anyway, a short while afterwards, after maybe an hour, 2 hours later on, we heard some shooting going on. And then we saw some of the patrol coming hurrying back. Now, that was part of the scheme. It wasn't cowardice, the man run away. In your build-up of patrols, you always had to get away men. As soon as you bumped into action, and the company patrol commander said, right, get away, tell them what's happened, we've bumped enemy up here. Their job was to get back and report where the enemy were. And these lads come running back and said, the corporal's been hit, pretty badly hit, and he's further up there. And without any thought or anything, I grabbed about six men with weapons, and I said, right, hoi, and I got the stretcher bearers, and we ran out, away in front of the battalion, and kept under cover in the jungle, and the lad had pointed more or less where the corporal is wounded. Now, all the section had left the corporal, because that is the instruction, you don't struggle if you can't get him back. Their job was to bring back information. So we went out and found the corporal badly wounded in the leg and the bottom, more or less at the bottom, bleeding badly. And I sent my men out, you know, all wrong protection, the six of them and myself, while the stretcher bearers handled him and they cart him back. And as soon as the stretcher bearers start moving off, we withdrew in bounds so that if anything cropped up, we could engage them. And we got this corporal back, and everyone was shattered about this particular corporal because he was so well liked. Anyway, he died. They'd hit a blood an artery up near his bottom, and they couldn't stem the flow of blood, and the next thing we got, no, he died. Two little incidents there. Now, this little place we're in, we heard shooting coming from one of our platoons up on top of the hill. And, of course, everyone wants to know, including Battalion HQ, including Brigade, what's the shooting at? What are they shooting at? It was a Japanese, one lone Japanese walking along the road towards us. And they decided to shoot him up. They should have let him come. We'd have grabbed him at Company HQ. They were wanting prisoners. And this man, they start shooting. And the word came out, let him come. But it was too late then. The man was looking around and mystified. But one of the rounds hit him and ricocheted up into his chest and killed him, because we went forward and got him and tried to get some information off him. But he's just one soldier that was lost. I thought they should let him come up and we could have nabbed him. That was another incident in this little place. So then we got orders to pull back once again.